Christy Smiley from Edinburgh City Corfball Club and Scotland. You're listening to the Half Court Press podcast.
I'm Pat Merton from Glasgow Corfball Club, and you're listening to the Half Court Press podcast.
Hi, I'm Neela Brennan, and I play for England Corfball and Trojans Corfball Club, and you're listening to the Half Court Press.
Coach's Corner is the latest series from the Half Court Press podcast. Here, Teo McLeod chats to a variety of coaches from different sports about what it is they do. We chat about coaching philosophies and techniques, youth development and team preparation, as well as how the individual fits into these concepts. If you're curious about coaching, then this is the podcast for you.
Hi, I'm John Bagnell, head coach of the Scotland Corfball National Team and Bristol Thunder Corfball Club, and you're listening to the Half Court Press podcast.
Hello, and welcome back to the Half Court Press podcast. You join us for our coaching specials with another corfball expert, John Bagnell. Hey, John, how you doing?
Hello, I'm well, thank you. Very happy to be here. I'm looking forward to talking all things corfball.
So we've done a lot of stuff about corfball in the past. If our listeners don't know much about corfball, listen back to some of the previous episodes. There's another one in this very much more recent series, but there's a back catalogue as well. There's stuff on our website, halfcourtpressmagazine.com. But John, could you give maybe a little introduction to corfball, as it's not a mainstream sport, but also a little background to yourself, please?
Yeah, of course. So corfball is a Dutch sport and is like a little bit of a variation of basketball and netball. But its unique qualities are really that you have a team of eight made up of four designated male players and four designated female players who all take a role, the same roles in both attacking and defending. And then what makes it unique from basketball and netball is that you're not allowed to actually shoot if the player is close enough to touch your chest. But you're also not allowed to dribble with the ball either. So with a lot of sort of the basis of the sport really is sort of quick passing and moving to get yourself free away from your defender to take that shot. You can go 360 degrees around the basket, and while half your team attacks, the other half defends. And then literally every two goals, you swap roles. So if you were defending, you're going to attack and vice versa. So a little bit about myself. So I'm originally from the northeast of England, as you might be able to tell by my outrageously strong Geordie accent, a lot of people say. But I got into corfball through university back in 2012, and then it progressed through various different clubs and various different stages. But I'm perhaps sort of now best known in the corfball community for being the coach of the Scottish national team and also the Bristol Thunder first team who compete in the English Premier League. So I do have many different hats in corfball, but that's probably what I'm best known for at the minute.
It's a hell of a commute from the south of England to the north of Britain.
Yeah, well, it's actually even more of a commute because I do actually live in Birmingham now. So, so a lot of travelling up to Edinburgh over the summer, and then during the winter more so, autumn and winter more so, I'm going up and down the M5 to Bristol for their sessions as well.
Why do you pick such far away sides to coach?
So I have a connection with Scotland corfball, quite a close connection, and that's where really I came through. So I started playing corfball at Oxford when I was at university down there, and played there for sort of two to three years, and then moved to Edinburgh where I was doing my postgraduate study. So I was in Edinburgh 5 years, so really had a lot of my formative years in corfball in Scotland. And so there's still a lot of close friends I have within Scotland corfball as well. And I've always cared a lot more about the development of the sport, I guess, in Scotland than maybe other regions. And then when the opportunity came up to coach the senior team, it was one that sort of I felt I could help with and do a lot of good in. And obviously it was a project that I'd been part of previously and sort of wanted to see through to the end. And then when it comes to Bristol, I think a lot of it was just down to sort of the vicinity of Premier League teams to my home address, and they were the nearest. And when they were looking for a coach, I sort of put my name forward. And we had very sort of productive conversations over the summer about how that would look and what our ambitions were for this season. It just all sort of clicked and felt right in the end. So that's sort of how I ended up in those two positions. It helps quite well that mainly the international season runs over the summer, and then the club season runs sort of over the autumn, winter. But it does mean I don't really get a break. for a lot of it. But, you know, if you enjoy something, it's worth doing.
What did you study?
So history originally. So I've actually gone all the way through. So I loved history. So I did my history undergraduate. And then what do you do if you've got a history undergraduate degree? You do a master's degree in history. And then what do you do if you do a master's degree in history? You do a PhD in history. And then it's you have to work out what you're going to do in the real world after that. So I left history then, but yes, I'm still sort of a keen amateur historian.
So you are coaching Scotland, you're coaching down in Bristol. What have your previous roles been?
So actually, I do also still coach at the university in Birmingham as well. So that's a lot of fun. I'm a very keen group. But prior to that, I coached the Birmingham team when they were in the Premier League for a short while. So I was co that coach there for 3 years. Prior to that, I coached at Edinburgh University when I was up in Scotland itself, and also had a very brief stint, just one tournament, coaching the British student team. And then last year, I was also one of the coaches on the England Corfball Academy, and ended up leading the under-19s team at a tournament in Catalonia just this past summer, which was a lot of fun as well, and a really great experience. So I've moved around a fair bit.
The Half Court Press is on social media. Feel free to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Moving on to our section on coaching, the way this series is working, the introduction, the coaching, and the winding up sections are all the same. Then the third section is going to be individualised to the guest. So to get you thinking a bit more about your own coaching ideas, what do you see as your role as a golfball coach? What are the important qualities of a coach?
Yeah, so I think golfball is quite a unique sport in that a lot of people come into the sport as an adult, and every player in the UK is an amateur. So my sort of main philosophy that I've always got across is that no matter what level you're playing it at, you have to enjoy it. Otherwise, a lot of these players are paying a lot of money to be there, to travel to tournaments and stuff. And if they're not enjoying it, they're not getting much out of it. There's no point in doing that. So for me as a coach, I think I have to facilitate that and have an awareness of what that club's needs are and how I can best sort of meet those needs. And so that's where sort of this, I guess, the key differences come when coaching the university side to coaching the Premier League or the international sides. And like in university, I just really want them to enjoy it. They're still learning. A lot of them are very new to the sport, having only played a year or two. They're there for a social aspect of it. But then when you progress to the higher level with the Premier League sides and the international sides, enjoying it also means being competitive, and wanting to win and wanting to do well. And so being able to match that and setting an important tone within that and then leading by example. Because you want to keep the group together, you want to keep the group united, and you want to keep the group all driving towards the same goal. So as a coach, sort of setting that culture, setting these sort of expectations early on, and making sure that all your players are bought into that. So in a sense, when it comes to being a coach, it's sort of being a leader of a group, but sort of setting the tone for that group mentality and making sure that everyone's on board with it and sort of we're all striving towards that same objective and everyone's pulling in the same direction to that.
This leads us on nicely to your coaching style. How would you describe your style of coaching, and how does this compare to other coaches that you've come across?
Yeah, so I think it's my style of coaching is I try to be sort of very positive in the way we play. I want my teams to be probably characterised as aggressive, but not sort of verbally aggressive or physically aggressive, but you know, in their style of play, just sort of being on the front foot, looking to score goals and looking to force over the turnover of the ball and defense, because I think that's how players enjoy it more. And I think ultimately, when it comes down to a sort of a game situation, the way you win a game is you score more goals than the other team. So we want to be positive and how in sort of trying to score goals and being aggressive in scoring goals, and but also being positive in stopping the other team from scoring as well. So try and sort of set our mark on the game, set the tone for the way the game's going to be played and make sure we're in control and that's how we want to play. With that, I think that also means sort of my teams generally have a certain characteristic or a certain style of play which they stick to. Whereas you might see other coaches who will try and adapt the way they play depending on the opponents. they face. And I'm not completely inflexible, but I do think there's a value in trying to sort of build in a style of play and working in that and having an identity as a team and the way you play. And for me, that becomes really important, especially when it comes to sort of international coaching, where often you have a lot of games in a very close period of time and a lot of time where you have no games building up to those games. Well, so during the tournament itself, it can be quite difficult to change things if things aren't working. But still having that, if you have that identity, that culture that works well, that you stick to, you have a core base that everybody knows to go back to, and it helps with keeping that team united and pulling together. That's what I try and do with my teams, as opposed to sort of being too adaptable game to game. We're just trying to have a sense of identity.
Would you have two or three systems set up at the international level with elite level teams or players? Would you go into a tournament, short tournament, with more than one system?
Yeah, definitely. You definitely have a backup. Because I think one of the things you have to be aware of is at times if plan A isn't working, you don't want to stick to plan A and just get beat. You want to be able to adapt somewhat and have that plan B, and if needed, maybe even a plan C that the team can work towards. But I think one of the unique challenges about international coaching is that the players don't really see each other week on week. So whereas at a club, you'd be training it probably once a week. Everyone will be together sort of that once a week. And you can sort of build in different systems and make sure people are used to that every week. At international level, you don't get that. So usually we're together one weekend a month across the summer. And so there's a challenge in trying to build those identities in. And so a lot of it goes down to sticking to ideas that everyone will know and everyone will be aware of, and then tweaking around it. So it's still familiar to them, but it's not a case of it's going to become too confusing or too complicated for them to build in.
So we're going to focus a bit more on international and elite level stuff in the next section of this episode. But more broadly on your coaching ideas, what are the important philosophies and principles to put across in your sports?
That's a really good question. I think sort of what Corfball is really has that really uniqueness, and it's still sort of its selling point. And I imagine it's something other guests have spoken about when they've talked about Corfball, but is that quality between players? It is a sport where you have different genders encompassed, but everybody needs to be able to do everything. And you don't want players to become pigeonholed so much in one specific role. You need them to be able to shoot, you need them to be able to defend, you need them to be able to rebound. And so getting across that sort of equality and making sure that everybody knows their role within the system. And so it's a little bit like a machine where you have 8 cogs and you want all the cogs to fit together nicely, but be able to switch those cogs around depending on how the game's going. So having that sort of sense of respect between all the players and making sure that, although to an extent you do have some specialism, some players will specialize in doing certain things, but making sure that they can also adapt. And you have that more sort of equal status between the players as well.
So you kind of touched on it a little bit there, the idea of specialist players. What are the processes in coaching the group and the team compared to the individual?
I guess when you focus on individual, it's more about technique and technical execution, whereas coaching a team, you're more focused on the tactical and the strategic. So getting across a system. So instead of sort of focusing on how an individual plays, focusing on how four players play together and a recognition of how those four come together to deliver a certain goal. So when it comes to coaching a team, in Corfball, I think sort of when coaching a team, coaching the individual is still an important aspect of that. And I think most Corfball coaches will say when they break down their sessions, they will have a part of a session where they talk about the individual and they focus on the technical execution, whether that be pass and shooting, individual defending. But then you have to build in that team aspect as well, where you're knowing how the ball needs to move, when to take the right shot in terms of defense, where you need your players to stand in terms of that gives you the best chance of stopping the other team from scoring more than anything. So it's definitely with a sense of team, you need to make sure you have four individuals that know how to work well together. And they all know what sort of the tactical and strategic objective is and how to execute that sort of group style play, as opposed to the focus on the individual technical execution.
How do you improve as a coach?
I think For me, there's two aspects of it, is that it's always being open to feedback and always like engaging in conversations. But with that is also having confidence in yourself and having confidence to make the right judgment calls. So what I mean by that more so is that it's always good to listen to other people and listen to other people's opinion and watch other teams play and get a sense of how they play. But you also have to have that confidence in yourself that you can recognize what you would do. And so if you have a situation where you take a certain action in a game and another individual or coach comes up to you and says that, or they would have done something differently, you need to have that confidence in yourself to either say, yeah, there's a point there, or also say, actually, I've considered that, but at the same time, I think I made the right call. I don't think that would have improved it. And then with that, you can always push yourself. You should never be shirked from any challenge, when, especially when you approach games, you're there in an even field as the opposing coach, and you always have something to give. And I guess that also feeds into that confidence, is that you've got to be confident to speak and get across your opinion, but then also recognize where you could have made a different decision that might have had a better outcome for you. So, yeah, I guess that's what I say. The classic answer of always be open, always listen, always watch and take on board, but also have confidence in yourself and just making sure that you know how to execute the right decision.
The Half Court Press is a multi-sport media outlet. You can check out our articles, opinion pieces, and PDF magazines on our website, www.halfcourtpressmagazine.com.
Elite coaching, domestic and international. This is the section a bit more tailored towards you and our conversation here for this episode. What are the specifics of coaching elite level players and teams? What and where is the focus?
Yeah, so I think korfball is a really unique sport in that you sometimes get players who come in and go into elite level sides, international sides, who really haven't actually been playing that long. So what the common aspect I think that goes across a lot is the trust that you need to have in elite level players. So in training sessions, when it comes to the elite level, the main focus really needs to be on sort of, for me, like that tactical and strategic element, sort of working on that gameplay style stuff, making sure that you can move the ball well, that players know where they need to move well, and how and what our sort of game plan is and how we execute that. But with that, you also need the players to be able to have high shooting percentages, and you need them to be able to know, sort of, yeah, be well in control of their own body, sort of have good discipline. And so you need to trust them that at the same time that they will be able to do that. And so, yes, in your training sessions, like you will have, like we talked about earlier, sort of aspects of it, especially sort of warm ups and stuff, where you do a lot of shooting, you do a lot of technical execution, but you may not focus so much on shooting technique, for example, with elite level players, because you trust that by the time they get to that point, you want them to be able to put the ball in the basket. And if they're struggling, you trust them to be able to go away on their own and work on that and practice that. And I guess part of that is also a bit of setting out certain expectations that you might not have with non-elite level competition or competition at lower down. So in terms of how they look after themselves out of the court, in terms of what they're eating, what they're drinking, and how they're looking after their own general fitness, and then how they approach games as well, sort of what mentality we need to approach games with in terms of being professional when they are at games. So they're turning up on time, they're turning up in good time, they're in their right kit, they're confident for the game ahead, and they are mentally ready to play, and setting a higher expectation. And a lot of that comes with how we carry ourselves as coaches as well, and making sure we model that as coaches. So, yeah, I guess for me, the key thing is the trust that you have in players, which allows you then to focus more on the tactical and strategic element of the game.
You began to touch on a question that came into my head there of, as a coach, how much of that is led by you? How much of the trust and expectation is discussed by you or brought up by you? Where does that culture come from? Where does that start?
That starts at the very beginning of any process and any journey that you undertake with a team. And I think for me, it's sort of how I begin any sort of new season or when it comes to internationals, new cycle and with the team is getting the team together and setting down what the expectations are for that team. Interestingly, with the Scotland national team, they're all expected to sign a code of conduct, which also includes how they carry themselves and how they look after their fitness outside of Corfball and how professionally they act when they're with the team as well. So that's actually written down and sort of contracted between us and the players. And as coaches, we also sign codes of conduct ourselves and we have to abide by them. But even sort of outside of that, when it comes to club coaching, at any level, I think it's important that you speak to the players openly at the beginning so that everybody knows what the expectation is. And a lot of times with clubs, you can engage in sort of wider conversations, perhaps between the coach and the committee and the wood players about what sort of club, what sort of team they want to be and what expectations you want to set from them. But you need to make sure early on that you're setting that standard, you're setting that tone, and then you're leading by example within that. So there'd be no point in me telling the players to turn up an hour before the game, then me rock up 20 minutes later with a can of lager in hand, for example, because they're not going to respect my request for them to be there an hour earlier and to be in a good state to play. So yeah, that begins at the very beginning and the coach should really lead on that.
If you're going to have a tinny on the go, don't go for lager. Have a nice pale ale or something, like a glass of wine perhaps. So there are many different sorts of coaches and roles of coaching. At the elite level, what are the similarities and the differences between being a lead coach and an assistant coach?
I think a lot of that sort of depends on the coaching team and the coaching setup. In an ideal world, you'd want sort of any lead coach to be able to pick the team they work with and pick sort of the assistants that they work with. And so I guess then it becomes up to them sort of what system they have. For me personally, when I work with assistant coaches or when I have been an assistant coach, my preferred sort of way forward is always to be part of the team. And so I want those assistant coaches there to not be afraid to give ideas, to be able to bounce ideas off me and also be a sounding board for ideas I have. So sometimes it may be that I have an idea and they are able to come forward and say, actually, I really don't think that's going to work. Or have you considered doing this way? Or saying, yeah, I think that's a good idea. Now let's work how we can execute that. Other coaches work differently. I've seen other coaches as well who is the lead coach want that sort of autonomy to set the strategy. And they use their assistants to execute their vision and their plan. And you can get a lot of different sort of types of assistant coaches as well. Sort of when you look at other sports such as rugby, where they have sort of scrum coaches, defensive coaches, back coaches, forward coaches, similar in Corfball. Like sometimes clubs and international teams have employed attacking coaches, they've employed defensive coaches and technical coaches as well, just to focus on sort of the more technical aspects of the game. But for me, when it becomes an assistant and it becomes the lead, the difference is really just who sets that strategy and who makes the final decision. And as a lead coach, you've got to be able to take on that responsibility. And also you take ownership for that as well. And so ultimately the players, the players should be working hard. They should be looking after themselves. They should be given 110% in games and they should be trying to execute that plan. And so if the plan isn't working as the lead coach, you have to be able to stand up and take responsibility for that and look after your players through that. Whereas an assistant coach perhaps doesn't have to have that level of responsibility, although there will still be some because they should contribute towards that plan. But yeah, it's sort of that weight of responsibility as a lead coach and sort of leading by example, leading forward and sort of working in defence and in support of the team as a whole. Hi, I'm John Bagnall, head coach of the Scotland Corfball National Team and Bristol Thunder Corfball Club, and you're listening to the Half Court Press podcast.
How does international coaching compare to club coaching? You spoke a little bit about it earlier on, but I'm looking to get a bit more detail on the day-to-day practicalities of running and coaching a league or domestic club side compared to an international team.
Yeah, so I think the main difference is sort of just the way this how the competition is structured. So I get a club team generally in a league, you'll play one game a week, and then sort of after that game, you have a week before the next game, and you'll have a few days hopefully before you train again, and then a few days after you train to play the next game. So that gives you a lot more time in terms of within the competition itself, in terms of being able to make adjustments, being able to make tweaks, and also doing a lot of analysis. I am a big fan of analysis. I'm an analyst by trade, and so my job is outside of Corfball. And so I do really value the time that you get in terms of watching a game back, looking at the stats from the game, having conversations with assistant coaches or team captains about what that says about the game itself, where improvements can be made, and then being able to plan the next training session with that in mind and to where we need to improve and what things we need to work on to then give yourself a better chance of executing those things better in the next game. And then over a longer period of time, then it also means that you don't have to panic as much. You shouldn't be panicking anyway, but it means like if your team loses a few games in a row, you've got time to turn it around. You've got time to wait for it to click and turn. But at international level, the sort of balance is a lot different. So the other thing I'd say about club level as well is the players are playing together and training together week on week over an extended period of time. When it comes to international level, that's different. So with Scotland, we train once a month over the summer, and we have sort of intense weekend camps. So the players train for 6 hours over the course of a weekend once a month, and they go away, and we might not see them again. That also means if a player has to miss a weekend, then they go a long period of time without being part of that squad. And sometimes that can happen over sort of very little thing, sort of a sore ankle, a sore back, something comes up in terms of transport. And so you have to be able to accommodate that, and you have to be able to balance those things. But generally, what you're trying to do is build an identity. You're trying to get players who may well have been strangers to each other prior to become more familiar with one another. And then building sort of a way, a strategy and tact and style of play with what we talked about before, with having a plan B and plan C, which you can then execute in a shorter period of time. So when you go away at the end of the when you go away to the tournament, usually at the end of that cycle, and you have to play 5 games in 5 days, that you're confident that you have that squad rotation element, that everybody knows what they're doing, everybody knows where they fit in, and that you can also make most of the time. So it often, a lot of people say, like, oh, it often seems quite glamorous that you jet around the world playing in Corfball tournaments, but when you're there, you're usually in the hotel. You wake up in the morning, you might have an hour's training session, you go back to the hotel, you have to talk about the game, you then go and play again, you come home, you're back to the hotel again, and you're sort of trying to watch as much of the game back as you can, you're making decisions on the team for the next day. And so it's very intense within that, and you've got to be able to react to that intensity. And with that as well, I think one of the key skills with international coaching is squad rotation, because at club level, it's not like it doesn't really happen that much, although some teams have been very successful using this sort of style, but you can really have a starting eight who you play the entire game, and then they go home for a week, they rest, and they come back and they play the next game. And so you don't use substitutes that much. But if you're going away and you're playing 5 games in 5 days, you're going to need to be able to use your whole squad a lot more. And so you need to be able to rotate them through, and you need to be able to rotate players through while still maintaining the standard and of play that you want and the style of play that you want. So a lot of what goes into that is sort of pre-tournament planning, where you might have an idea of who will play in which game, but you have to be able to react to how the tournament's going in real time and be able to make quick adaptations to that.
What's the process of that rotation? Is there a, at youth level, I do a lot of youth coaching, is I get a balance of, all right, that kid's going to be a bit older, a bit more physically mature, perhaps a bit more experienced in terms of ability and training age. And the next to that player, or just a front or behind of that player, I've got a less experienced kid. Do you do a similar thing at international level?
Yeah, in a manner of speaking, that we need to get the balance of the team right. So we need to make so in Corfball, really, you pick two divisions. So you pick almost two teams of four. So you need to make sure each of your division is well balanced, and that when you're rotating the squad through, that you're not losing too much of one attribute in one end, and having too much of another attribute in another end. And then also being able to adapt the style of play to that. And so for us, that goes through a lot of having conversations as a coaching team and thinking more widely about how we might play, depending on which combinations of player we have. And that allows us to switch plans if games aren't working well. We can also bring players off and put them back on, which is another sort of unique aspect of corfball in the same game. We can have rolling substitutes, a bit like basketball or ice hockey. So that's a very important aspect as well. So a lot of it goes into pre-planning. But then, like I said, you don't know how the game's going to go. And sometimes, and I think one of the unique things about international corfball as well is that we can have some teams that we find it really difficult to find out a lot about. And so we may plan one way, and then when we turn up to the tournament, they play a completely different way than what we expected, or they've got completely different players than what we expected. And then you have to be able to adapt. And so it's having that sort of wider sense of what your team's strengths are, how you can switch that around at short notice, again, to give yourself the right balance and the right attributes you need on court to win that specific game.
I can't quite remember. I think it was a Liverpool coach. It was a football coach of some description. He went, football would be simple if it wasn't for the opposition.
Yeah, and I think that's true. That's like sort of a good analogy for any sport generally. But like when it comes to corfball as well, it's sort of, I guess, one of the main differences. You get elite level rugby, elite level football, even, I guess, to an extent, something like elite level field hockey. Teams will know more about their opposition than they will at international corfball. Now, club level corfball, it's easier to find out information about other teams, and generally you will know the players at other teams, you know the coaches, and you can get a sense of style and you can adapt for that. But international level, it can be so hard to learn about players or teams who play in a small amateur sport on the other side of the world. And you have to be able to adapt for that. And you have to be able to make those quick time decisions to give your team the best chance of winning. But while also being confident in your core, in your own style, will serve you well for the majority.
How much sharing of information do you like lend each other videos of opponents and stuff like this?
Next to none, unfortunately. It is sort of a big thing within corfball, and personally I think it would grow the sport quite well in that if there was sort of more games sort of shared on a more open platform. And actually there is sort of a little bit of a culture, sort of especially within club corfball in England, where clubs don't want to share that information or that footage because they don't want somebody else to get an upper hand on how they play. The International Corfball Federation are now very good at sort of every sort of tournament that they run and make sure all the games are streamed. But sometimes you're looking at a year-old footage of teams, and then they turn up and they've got a completely different team with a new coach. And so you don't know how they're going to play. Yeah, so personally, I think it would be better for the sport if people could share videos more widely. And I think it would enable better gameplay. It would also enable better coaching across the board, as it would make that sort of analysis element a lot more important. But yeah, unfortunately, at the minute, it's a bit non-existent.
Is there a difference in coaching, learning, communication between the genders?
Not really, to be honest. And I think that's probably one of the beauties about corfball, is that it really does push that idea of equality between genders, all genders. Everybody has an important role to play. Everybody needs really to be able to do everything. And I think what's probably more important how you coach is depends on the individual characteristic and what you want that specific player to do within your style of play. Now, to an extent, you might have to do that a little bit on gender in terms of like some of the rules of corfball, where only people sort of the same designated gender are allowed to mark up against each other and allowed to defend each other. So you use that to an advantage in terms of, like, do you try and block other players off? Do you try and use certain moves to get better positions around the basket or better shooting positions by exploiting that rule? But in terms of when it comes to sort of like individuals, it's really down to the individual characteristic and what you're trying to bring out. And equally, as you get brilliant players from both genders, you also get brilliant coaches from all genders as well, which again, I think is a great thing about corfball. And sort of really pushing that idea of equality and sort of everybody's importance in the sport.
The little I know about corfball is it seems to be quite, although the player-to-player marking style is binary, it seems to be quite inclusive of a spectrum of genders.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, sort of, Korfball sort of 40 years ago, I guess, was considered a little bit ahead of its time, where it had sort of male and female players playing together. And now it is trying to adapt to sort of the whole spectrum of gender equality. And although that there is going to be difficulty within that, I think credit has to be given to sort of the powers that be within Korfball for addressing that issue. And trying to find a solution towards that. I mean, they're having sort of a wider engagement, which they currently are now, to try and find a solution for that. So to ensure that Korfball remains inclusive for all.
The Half Court Press is on social media. Feel free to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
As we begin to wind up, who or what inspired you to go into coaching?
Oh, it's an interesting question, because my coaching sort of journey began when I was very young, actually, as a football coach, as a youth football coach. And I was a sort of 14, 15, coaching players my age and younger. And I got through that through my dad. So I'm a big fan of all sports. But I'm particularly a big fan of football. Without trying to alienate a large portion of your audience, I am a passionate Sunderland Football Club supporter. Always have been. And passionate about my football as well. And so seeing sort of some of the top sort of football coaches through that, and sort of as a youngster not being particularly good at football, so also knowing I was never going to make it as a player, sort of saying, what other ways could I get involved in the sport? And so that's how I fell into coaching itself. And then with Korfball coaching, it just I think it more became from being in a scenario where I was an experienced individual, I guess, amongst less experienced individuals, and I had some knowledge which I thought would help. And then that's how I started in it, just wanting to help. And even now, right the way through to international and sort of the Premier League coaching as well, and that is the main motivation a lot of the time, is wanting to help. And wanting players to get better, and wanting to share my knowledge with others and share sort of my passion for this sport with others to help them sort of experience their passion as well. So that's always been sort of my motivation, really, within Korfball coaching. It's just wanting to help others and wanting to see others improve within that, and being able to use what knowledge and experience I have to aid with the wider development of the sport.
Who are your favourite coaches of all time?
Oh, there's so many to choose from. I think sort of when it comes to coaches themselves, a lot of it comes from football, to be honest, because that was the sport I followed mostly when I was a youngster. And I guess sort of you have the sort of traditional sort of answers of Alex Ferguson, Pep Guardiola. But for me, being sort of from a Northeast boys, passionate Sunderland football club, my two actually favourite coaches were Peter Reeds during his time as Sunderland manager, and how he sort of took on the identity of not just the team but also the wider city, and assembled sort of a coaching team around him with people like Bobby Saxton, who sort of enveloped the culture of the city and the people of Sunderland, and then got the team to play within that. And then was very successful as Sunderland manager, sort of two successive seventh place finishes in the Premier League. And then the last one, which is probably still more relevant, and I guess to some young viewers, would be Roy Keane. So obviously Roy Keane's first ever coaching job was at Sunderland. And I think what was particularly unique about that moment was the way in which he took a team who at the time was second bottom and flipped them to winning the league in the same season. And I thought that showed a lot of the importance of mentality and sort of tactical and strategic play. And that you certainly had the players within the squad who were talented enough, but it was just they were coming off the back of a really bad time. And I think more recently, one thing I would say is a coach who I've been really sort of inspired by, Sabrina Wiegman, and what she's done with the England Lionesses as well and the women's team. And I think she's sort of done what she's done particularly well, is sort of moulding that culture and identity within an international team, which can be tricky, especially when you're coaching a group of players who come from clubs who are traditionally very big rivals with each other. And so competing against each other one week, but then being able to bring them together as a team, as a squad, and ultimately as a family, and all the success that the Lionesses have had under her leadership, and I'm sure they'll have many more to come as well.
Who have been the best coaches that have trained you as a player?
Oh gosh, harping back somewhat. So I think when I first started in Scotland, the national team coach of Scotland was a lady called Beth Lauren. And she was sort of the first person that introduced me to international or elite level coaching and what it took to sort of partake in elite level sport within that. So I wasn't actually part of her squad for very long. She was in, say, Scotland for very long after I arrived. But sort of that introduction was important to me, and it sort of gave me a sense of what elite level coaching was. And actually the Scotland team under her leadership did really well and was probably at its peak, its most recent peak in history. So yeah, I'd probably have to cite her as being a really sort of positive influence.
Who have been the best coaches that you've coached with?
I think the biggest influence for me was a chap called Colin Martin. So Colin was the Scotland head coach at the time that I first became his assistant. And what sort of began, and I didn't really know him beforehand. We'd had a telephone conversation around something else, and because I was coaching Birmingham at the time, and he phoned me about something to do with English Corfball, and then we started talking about Scotland Corfball, and that he'd just become head coach, and sort of the seeds were planted then. And then when he advertised that he was looking for an assistant, I got in touch again and went with that. And so, but over the 18 months that we worked together, he was such a big influence on me, and I learned so much from him. He was so experienced, so knowledgeable, and he was always willing to listen and help as well, and help me develop. And in working with him, I always felt that was very important to him, to see me develop. And actually, I'm still in touch with him now. So even though he's moved away from Scotland, Corfu, I do still speak to him very regularly. And he has become very much like a mentor to me, which is really good to know, and always good to have someone of that level of experience. Because he was very successful as both a player and a coach himself back in his heyday, he won't mind me saying. And then sort of thinking wider past that, when I was part of the England Academy, I worked with two coaches, Steph Watson, who coaches Highbury Corfball Club at the minute, and also Saskia Carr-Taylor. Me and her did a tournament in Catalonia together with the England Under-19 team. And they are two very good coaches. I think we'll both have very big futures as coaching in the sport, both very successful players as well in their time. And so the way, like, the connections they made with their players, the way they carried themselves with coaching and how they imparted their experience on a younger generation of players was actually really valuable for those players and really good to see. And I felt really privileged to be part of that as well. So yeah, those were the three. So Colin, Steph and Saskia, I would say, are up there.
Who are your favourite coaches currently working in Corfu?
Oh, so I guess on a sort of international level, it comes to mind, and probably coaches people are more aware of. And I do apologise if I mispronounce this wrong, but I do believe it is pronounced Fan Jixia, who is the head coach of the Chinese Taipei national team. I think what she has done with that team has been brilliant. The way they have progressed into really one of the most dominant forces in international corfball, and the investment that they've made and how she's worked with those players and got them. And then ultimately just by doing sort of the basics well, that they have a very obvious style of play that they do very well, and sort of represents what I said about that sort of having that core base that you can go back to in international corfball, and how that's contributed to the growth of corfball within that country. It's been really inspiring to see. So I really enjoy watching the Chinese Taipei team play, and especially sort of under her coaching. And then another one I would talk about, and I shouldn't really say this because we're competing in the same tournament at the weekend, actually, but guy Ross Carr-Taylor, who is currently the head coach of the Wales team. And it's been really good to see actually what he's done with that Welsh team and sort of how he's got them playing together. And sort of, with no disrespect to the coaches that went before him, but seeing the improvement that has been made in those individual players and how they come together as a team, and the good he's done for corfball within Wales as well, is really good to see. So yeah, those two, I would say, are my standouts at the moment.
John Bagnall of Corfball Scotland and Bristol, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
This has been a Half Court Press production by Teo McLeod. If you have enjoyed this show, please leave us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts and Facebook.